Hey, Ross, you've got a podcast, haven't you?
Yes, I do, actually.
What's it called?
Imaginary Advice.
What?
Imaginary Advice. It's called Imaginary Advice.
Imaginary Advice?
Yes.
That doesn't mean anything.
Well, no, it does mean something.
From hearing that title, I know absolutely nothing.
It's a storytelling podcast.
So it's not an advice podcast?
No.
Yeah, or like some kind of spoof advice podcast?
No.
Because that would make sense. So people can't write in with their problems and then you give them advice? Like Midnight Caller with Gary Cole?
No, I don't do that. I don't give advice.
But the word advice is literally in the title.
I'm aware of that.
Your podcast is called Imaginary Advice.
Yes.
It should be a spoof advice
I tell stories, and some of them are true and then some are fiction. But I mean, I'd say if they had something in common, I'd say they all tend to call attention to themselves as stories. Sometimes episodes are more like essays, but even then they tend to be essays about storytelling in some way, mostly. Look, I know that sounds vague, but I don't know. I've never been good at just stepping back and seeing the bigger picture. And that's why it's hard for me to describe what it is. And I wish that wasn't the case, but, you know.
You used to have a good job.
I know.
What was wrong with working for the Alliance in Leicester?
Yeah, I mean...
And now you sit in a wardrobe and talk to yourself.
Yeah.
You spend all your time making an advice podcast...
Okay.
...that doesn't offer any advice whatsoever.
Yeah.
And no one listens to.
Several people listen to it.
You'll never be happy.
All right, mate. If you want the real reason, I'll give it to you. I called it Imaginary Advice as a playful way to draw attention to the pedagogical traditions of storytelling. You know, if you think of like a Bible parable, that's a kind of form of imaginary advice, isn't it? Any story with a moral at the end, that's imaginary advice. But the idea is you're meant to follow the teachings of the story, right? It's instructional. It tells you how to live. But when you describe it in that way, when you call these stories imaginary advice, well then like the phrasing of that's intentionally ambiguous. It's as if the moral at the end of the story might also be part of the fictional construct. The instructional aspect of the story is brought under suspicion. Like the moral is as fake as anything else. It's my way of saying, don't follow my advice. I made it all up. And that's why I called it imaginary advice. And I don't fucking care who gets it.
You were playfully drawing attention to the pedagogical traditions of storytelling.
I hear that tone. You don't have to... Who the fuck are you anyway? Do I know you? I don't think we know each other.
And yet, you'll never escape me.
Oh my God, what are you doing to my curtains?
Decorating.
Advice. Selected highlights from the first 100 episodes.
Hello. My name is Ross Sutherland. At the time of recording this podcast, I am 5'10" in height. I am I'm 34 years old. It's one day before my 35th birthday, and I am currently sitting in the bottom of a wardrobe in a house that I rent in a beautiful part of the British Isles known as Peterborough. When people ask me what I do for a living, I tell them that I'm a writer, although no one actually employs me to do that as a job, at least not on a full-time basis. Nevertheless, like, I try to fill my days writing a mixture of poetry and stories and essays. And then in the evening, I go out and I read my work to small rooms full of people. And that's pretty much my life. I don't make a lot of money, but I have low overheads. If you go into HSBC, they have an espresso machine that you can use for free. Just say that you're Just say that you're waiting for a friend who's in the middle of having their boat remortgaged, and they'll leave you alone. Everyone, in fact, everyone on the planet will leave you alone if you just give them a good enough reason. And then you can get on with the important stuff. And for me, that's talking to yourself in the bottom of a wardrobe. Okay, well, it's primarily writing, and the whole wardrobe thing is kind of secondary. It's just my voice sounds better in here. That's just through trial and error. I've discovered this, that if you want to do like a recording of something, I don't have good enough recording equipment to just like sit at my dining table and record it. But in here, it's quite good. It's, you know, it kind of muffles the sound a bit. I used to do all my recordings under the duvet. But everything that I said just sounded like 80% more depressing when you're kind of delivering it from a horizontal position. Anyway, yeah, so... but this wardrobe is good. It's okay. I'm not depressed by this wardrobe. I know it feels a little bit... You know, I'm about to turn 35. From the outside, it might look a little bit like I'm in the middle of having some sort of nervous breakdown. But I'm not depressed by this wardrobe at all. I feel empowered by it, you know, like, I don't know much about numerology, but the number 35, it feels like a powerful number. And when those numbers come around, you got two choices. Either you try to fight against that power, or you try and find a way to use it, to turn it to your advantage. So that's why I'm sitting in the wardrobe. I'm taking control of my destiny. I've got all these things that I've written over the last few years, and no one is ever going to hear them again if I don't find a way to put them out there. So that's why I said to myself, Ross, you have to set up one of those audio subscription services that they have now. You can put a new episode out about once or twice a month. They can be quite short, just like 10 to 20 minutes each. You can upload some old recordings of stuff you've done before, but you can also use the space as a sketchbook for trying out new ideas. And you can sort of try and work to the format yourself. You can do this, Ross. And yes, real life will probably get the better of you in the end. You'll be distracted by a new video game or a new job or that massive coronary that's clearly waiting for you down the road. But come on. Everything ends, Ross, right? There's no reason not to start. I mean, just look at all these coats. All these old winter coats that keep getting in your face as you try to record this. Ross, I'm still addressing you in the third person right now, Ross. Ross, when you bought this coat, when you took it to the till, you genuinely believed that this was the last coat that you'd ever need. I mean, would you wear it now? No, it's like a trench coat with a hood. It's stupid, it's ridiculous. So why don't you throw it away then? Because there was some point in your life when a trench coat with a hood made sense to you. And that's kind of like this podcast. That's why you're doing it. It's just a record of your misplaced enthusiasm. It's a record of your very best mistakes. It's a trench coat with a hood. And maybe it's going to haunt you forever because deep down, Ross, that's what you think you deserve. But it still should be recorded somewhere for posterity. Because that's important somehow. Oh, dear. I think it's really dusty in here.
Hey, mate. Down here, mate. Mate, this song is banging, respects. I said, respect, mate. Do you know what would be good next? Do you know what would be good next? Do you know you're busy? Sorry, mate, I said, mate, what the fuck is this one? What the fuck is this one? Oh my God. Holy shit, it's like an image of a baby, mate. It's like a wicked rainbow in a field of yes, mate. Fuck, I could kiss an X-ray technician under a foil sky. Who's with me? Who's with me? Here, have some of this pink
Bart Simpson champagne cocktail in a wind tunnel, you fucking legends.
So do you buy your baseball caps online or... I came here with my dick in my hand. Don't make me leave here with my foot in your ass.
Be cool.
I came here with my dick in a bag. Don't make me leave here with one foot in the past.
Be cool.
I came here with a dick in my band. Don't make me leave here with my foot in a cast.
Be cool.
I came here as a chickenogram. Don't make me leave here in a Renault Espace.
Be cool.
I came here for the knitting exam. Don't make me leave here without booking the class.
Be cool.
I came here with a cardiogram. Don't make me leave here with a lithograph. I came here with my dick in some jam. Don't make me leave here with a chicken madras.
Be cool.
I came here with meticulous plans. Don't make me leave here with a homeopath.
Be cool.
I came here with a pitcher of Wham. Don't make me leave here with a full tank of gas.
Be cool.
I'm King Lear, give me 65 grand. Don't call me Ramirez when I'm shopping for hats. I came here in a rickety van. Don't take that pizza in my beautiful bath. Good day, weird with a dick is my brand. Don't make me sit here with a poo in my pants. I came here with the Michelin man. Don't make me leave here with a mountain of trash. I gave her all my picnic ham. Don't make me leave here when my school's understaffed. A Kaylee with a slippery gran. Don't make me leave her in a fountain of cash. I came here with a rip in my pants. Don't wait for me, dear, in the loo round the back. I came here reading Kubla Khan. Don't make me with a delivery gran.
Oh my, oh, jeez. What happened? God, you know, it's, 1 second. I was just trying to get some sleep right down here on the bottom of my wardrobe. You know, I thought I'd just pop in here and crawl up on the floor and, you know, make a pillow out of this huge pile of ironic work shirts that I bought in the early noughties. I thought, oh God, this would be nice. Just, it's so nice and quiet in here and smells of sawdust, the fabric conditioner. It's just so nice in the wardrobe, just so warm and uncomplicated that I thought I'd just have a little sleep, just a quick little sleep. And then, you know, later on today, I can work out what to do about my career and my future and all that stuff. But for now, you know, just have a little sleep. But then there was this loud noise. Probably just like the postman putting something through my door, or maybe my cat screaming at its own reflection. But whatever that noise was, it surprised me so much that I sat up really fast. And I think, I think that I sat up so fast that for a second, I pierced the space-time continuum. I think just for one moment, I just nudged myself out of the time flow. And as I did that, I managed to just turn my head just far enough to the side that I saw all the other universes. So billions and billions and billions of other universes that all ran parallel with mine. You know, every decision that I could have made, every conceivable crossroads, right? And it was chaos, right? It was utter chaos. Now, I don't know if you've watched that film on the internet where someone has overlaid every single episode of Friends on top of each other. But that's what it felt like. It's like this kind of gooey, soporific blur. But then, like, I noticed something in the blur, right? Something that was always the same. No matter what universe you were in, there was this single convergence point in every single universe that I saw, there was the New Orleans Grammy-nominated rapper Mystical. I don't know why he was always there, but he was. He was always there. I don't know. Maybe, perhaps, every timeline requires there to be a rapper called Mystical. I don't know. Maybe he's some sort of quantum stud that anchors the multiverse. You know, some sort of non-skippable cutscene in this sandbox adventure that we call Planet Earth. So, you know, I saw him, right? I saw Mystical and he saw me. But when he began to sing his song to me, the Neptunes produced Shake Your Ass from his fourth album, Let's Get Ready. When he started to sing that song to me, I heard not one song, but every song, every possible combination of words he could have possibly uttered. And sure, some of those songs felt like thinly veiled sexual threats, and, you know, maybe feel really uncomfortable. Others were about food, something about homeopathic doctors. I can't really remember, but here's the point. Here's what it showed me. It showed me that beneath the ebb and flow of language, the essence of all the songs was the same. I came into this world knowing that I wanted to do something fun. I don't want to leave this world having done something awful. I want to be cool. That was what I heard. That was what I heard hidden inside Mystical's beautiful voice. Inside that chorus of angels, I heard a voice that cries out, I want to be cool. And maybe that is why there is a Mystical in every timeline. Because he's like 2001 monolith. You know, he's God's word made stone. No, that's probably not true, is it? No.
Mate, hold my hand. Hold my hand. Hold my hand. Hold my hand. Yes, mate. Listen. I forgot.
I stick a saltwater tank on the back of my truck and drive my octopus around the city of Cambridge. Down King's Parade, Market Square, past vintage bookshops, the delivery entrance of Dixon's. Me and the first octopus on Earth to ever see the spires of Corpus Christi. We crawl past picture book parks, cyclists weaving diagrams around us. My octopus has never known the sun to burn so bright and yet so cold. His huge eyes rotating, taking in every dog, every girl raising a crisp to her mouth, every medieval crack and splinter. I toot my horn. He waves at pedestrians.
Cambridge loves you, baby. You're unscrewing this city like a jam jar.
He salutes me. But I know the deal. I know if he wanted, he could sucker off over those high campus walls. He could squeeze through a fissure no bigger than a thumb and be gone, absorbed into the colleges, beyond those black turrets where teenagers dream in a dead language, beyond those ancient refectories, past suits of armour, into studies once paced by Charles Babbage, rearranging those blue plaques like shells in his cave, designing some kind of brand new historical assembly. He'd be Dean of Peterhouse by Christmas. I go to turn left onto Trumpington Street. For a second, we lock eyes. I turn off the indicator. Mill Lane it is then. It's the arrogance of the octopus that seduces us. All action in all directions. A story made entirely of twists.
Who wouldn't want to follow behind us? Our path reminiscent of the ancient river that cut this city in two. This endless, unquestionable life force that every student relies upon to make them feel utterly stupid.
Up you come, cried Father, and we climbed up onto his shoulder pads. Me on the left shoulder, my sister on the right. Father always preferred to carry us, particularly when navigating crowds of unhappy miners. All this was part of the daily family ritual. The streets to and from school were always blocked by weeping miners, all of them utterly unconsolable because they didn't like the new David Bowie album. A bit rushed, they would say, in between fits of tears. And not a patch on Let's Dance. In those days, the internet was on cassette tapes. I had two BuzzFeed cassettes, also National Rail Enquiries, and Wikipedia volume 17, 19, and 42. After school, I would lie under the trampoline in the rain and listen to the internet on my Walkman until Mother called me in for green crisps and our nightly performance of Starlight Express. On Friday nights, Father would bring home a prawn cocktail wrapped in the latest Beano. After sharing the prawns, we would flatten the paper and enjoy the exploits of Dennis the Menace best we could in amongst the transparent panels of grease. Prawn windows, we used to call them. The stories had so many holes that the menacing made little sense, truth be told. A prawn window over the final panel was particularly perplexing. The Beano for us was a world full of angry, knobbly-kneed children ranting between blackouts, the occasional thumbs up to a dog. All in all, a world we recognised intimately, which is probably why we all adored it. Of all the children on the street, my sister and I were the glossiest. Mother sellotaped a neon bar to each of my shoulder pads, and I would walk up and down the road, all aglow, sometimes singing the theme tune to Terror Hawks. I was 5. My sister was 3. Sometimes another child would pull the battery out the back pocket of my shorts and I would cry. Mother always said that the other children were jealous because they weren't members of the Ian McNaught Davis fan club. And after that, I would sleep soundly, nuzzling my stocks in Comshare till morning. My best friend was Belinda, the only girl who ever played the Pac-Man board game with me. When autumn came, Belinda's mother told her that the family was leaving Essex. Her father had won a job in Wigan, birthplace of the removable hairpiece. On the day she left, I was beside myself with grief. I crouched in a pond, clutching The Guardian's lukewarm review of Muppets Take Manhattan for the best part of an hour. But all was forgotten by 7 o'clock when the family received its daily perms. Saturday mornings, my friends and I would stand behind the roller disco, practicing our surprised faces, until the owner would come and shoo us away with a Stephen King novel. Our bicycles had 3 sound effect buttons, and we were wont to press them, particularly in the winter, as the microchips generated a small quota of warmth. The first button was a recording of Margaret Thatcher saying, "It's a funny old world." The second was a recording of a machine gun. The third was an owl hooting. Together, these 3 sound effects told quite a story. A different story, in fact, depending on the order you push them. An insane Margaret Thatcher firing a machine gun and startling an owl. An owl somehow firing a machine gun to the amazement of Margaret Thatcher. a mysterious machine gun startling an owl, much to the condemnation of Margaret Thatcher. A mysterious machine gun startling Margaret Thatcher, much to the condemnation of an owl. An owl noticed by Margaret Thatcher for its magical beauty before being gunned down by a machine gun. Finally, Margaret Thatcher talking to herself before being ambushed by an owl with, yes, a machine gun. A plethora of combinations, more than enough for any young boy. By the time I'd worked through the entire repertoire, it would usually be time for bed. My duvet was a section of the Berlin Wall, covered in beautiful German graffiti, all the colours of the rainbow. I remember it being incredibly heavy. It was possibly the greatest year of the century, if not of all time. I don't think anyone has anything bad to say about 1984. Things were just better. All of us were so stupidly perfect. It was as if the entire planet was being processed through the naivety of a child. Oh, it was heaven. A cola bottle dropped into cola. If only I could go back there, to that endless summer, when a frog chorus echoed over Braintree like the wind blown right through my heart. If there was a vote to take us back to 1984 once more, if someone, anyone, came forward with a plan to reinstate that miracle year, I would pop my cross in the box faster than you can scream, "Do you know it's Christmas?" Let me vote for 1984. And burn everything after, please. Take me back to this magical place where there is no darkness.
Mate, have you got bent green microscope fannies by Teenagers' Tears? No, hang on, I fucked up. Sorry, mate. Shit, that made no sense. I'm wasted. I meant, have you got bent green microscope fannies by Teenagers' Tears? No. No. Sorry, mate. I said I'm sorry. I did a fuck ton of Dobby poison tonight. Proper teleported haircut, mate. Look at me, I got eyes like a rain-filled diamond mine, and I. Too many people on the balcony, mate. I can't think in straight lines, I tell you. What I meant to say is, have you got a lucky egg with my face on it? Hello, hello, welcome, welcome, come on in. It's a 2-year birthday party for Imaginary Advice. No, thanks for coming. It's alright, mate, we got a lot of wine, you're covered. Do you like Boone's Farm? It's melon ball flavoured, hence the colour. It's all I drink, actually, apart from, I do occasionally like a can of Apple Tango with some speed dissolved in it. There we are, here you go. So, hey! All right, so these are all the other podcasts that come up on the listener also subscribed to bit at the bottom of my iTunes page. Hey, Book Slam Podcast, how's it going?
Hello and welcome to the Book Slam Podcast.
Welcome, welcome.
Yep, glad to hear it. Okay, so let me introduce you to these two. This is the Soundproof podcast from ABC, and The Lapse. They're both storytelling podcasts with an emphasis on sound design. I haven't actually listened to either of them yet.
My name, at least until sound next episode, Soundproof. Is Vile Pest. Sound. This was the Lapse.
Classic. Hang on, guys. Hold on to that thought. I'm just going to change the CD over.
Anybody gonna dance? Yeah? Just me? No, no, okay, that's all right, fine. I'm gonna refresh everybody's drinks. Okay, this song's too loud, isn't it? I'm gonna put it back down. Hang on, watch out. It's Outlook from BBC World Service. You all right, mate?
Hello, I'm Matthew Bannister. Welcome to the Outlook podcast. Do you remember this music?
Yeah.
It was the theme song of the Rugby World Cup in South Africa just over 20 years ago. A big moment.
Fucking twat. Listen, I think this party's just pretty much going to run itself. I've got some wham bar and fake avocado pasties in the oven, but they're going to be about half an hour, I think. So, I've taught them all how to play Super Monkey Ball, haven't I? So, you know, I feel like my job as host is pretty much done for now. Do you want to just hang out? You know, just us a while. I mean, I want to show you something anyway. You know, just come through into the library for a moment. I know, right? It just turns out his flat's a lot bigger than it looks. God, sorry about the mess. Hang on, let me just move all these half-finished vagina paintings. Just stick it over there, mate. You know, grab the easel. Just move the whole lot. Okay, let me just move you here. I'm just gonna just stand here, right on this central hexagon. You see, on the tiles, you know, it's a hexagon. Okay, just stand there, right there in the middle. Okay, excellent. Now I just gotta find the right book. Okay, now here it is. Yeah, I Don't Believe It, Richard Wilson's Book of Absurdities. It's a real book. It's just a list of things that Richard Wilson doesn't believe. But it's also a lever. Hold on to your stomach. Okay. Here we go. You know what, I put in this elevator when I first moved into the house. Yeah, it turns out you don't even actually need planning permission to build an underground layer. I say layer, it's more of a kind of... No, actually, layer's the right word. Okay, here we are. Well, now it smells a bit. You just look, take this and put it in there when I say three, okay? One, two, three. Cool. Thanks.
Amder voice key now.
This is Imaginary Advice. Thanks for listening.
Validated.
It's pretty big, huh? So, you know, obviously this is where Imaginary Advice really happens. Obviously I don't actually record it here. In the bottom of a wardrobe. What kind of a sad man would actually do that, eh? No. Obviously I really do it all down here. Before we go any further, just some basic workshop ground rules. Don't wander off into any of the catacombs. Don't touch that button that does the funny voice. If you want to give me a 5-star review on iTunes, then that's great. Otherwise, it's fine, don't worry about it. Like, I'm worried about becoming too popular anyway. You know, if you really like it, just keep it to yourself. You know, like, can't we just have one thing that's just about us, eh?
Imagine.
Well, okay, I said no one. I'm the only one who's allowed to touch the funny voice button. Okay, the timing's very, very particular. Just, all right, look, it doesn't matter. Let's get started.
Do you like Sainsbury's? I said, do you like Sainsbury's? All right, mate, yeah, it's me again. Do you like Sainsbury's? That's where I work. That's where I work, night shift. If you ever want anything from Sainsbury's, then let me know, yeah? I'll sort it out, anything. I can give you my number if you want. Look, I can give you my number. I can give you my number. I'll give it to you at the end of the night. Yes, mate, wicked tune. I love it, mate, love it. Sometimes, right? at work, I put on all the thermal jackets at the same time, and then I go to sleep in the walk-in freezer, yeah? Make a little pillow out of the frozen peas. I'm a rebel, mate. Both of us, yeah, fucking rebels. Shake my hand. I'm like you. I got the music in me, like crying hostages. Yes, mate. Good night. Hey, did you catch the sport that was on? It's just I saw that you're wearing a sport uniform. What sport is that? Oh yeah, that's a classic sport. I love that game. Do you know that's it's probably my top five games. What specific team costume is that though? What team's your favourite? Uh-oh, not that one. Not to brag, but my team are significantly more skilled than your team. How many sport crystals have you guys got? Not many. In fact, my team just won another sport crystal this weekend. Yeah. Actually, it was a secret bonus crystal. Most people didn't know about it. Do you know, mate, this late in the season, I don't think there's anyone that could stop us winning now, not even the army. Last week, right, my team, they painted this watercolour of them holding up the victory cup, and it was incredibly realistic, you know, like photorealist. You know, people say that we're the Kim Jong-il of sport. Your pitch is, you know, our green screen. Have you even seen this season? We've been clinking Zeppelins in the top end, you know. We've been malleting horses match after match. We've got majority control over four lucrative heavy oil projects. You know, we've done very, very, very good indeed. Unlike your team. Who are, let's face it, they are a bunch of potatoes. They're a fancy dress shop on fire, pardon my French. They're like early CGI dinosaurs. They're a funeral buffet, mate. Face it. Also, don't think we haven't noticed that you keep swapping out older players, replacing them with younger players. Did you think that we wouldn't know that somehow the football players of West Ham could still be 25 years old despite the fact that the team was founded in 1895? Clearly, substitutions have been made. Did you think that sports teams couldn't die? All teams die, mate. All teams die. But my team dies last, yeah? My team dies last. What's that sound? Oh yeah, that's right. That's a bomb going off in sport. Your team just happened to be shopping for perfume in the wrong part of the mega mall. Your township burning in the last light of a sixth century. Death threats sung like hymns. The fog of death rising from the stands. Some goals can never be erased. We goal by the divine right of the supreme architect of sport.
Oh hell, sport!
Oh hell, the bull-headed murderer of Sundays. Hail, all sport! Okay, now I understand. You gotta be getting back. Okay, yeah, I understand. But
Sport forever, though, yeah? Let's do that handshake. Sport forever. Good enough. Sport forever, yeah?
I'll see you next toilet break. I'll be here, yeah? I'll be waiting. I love sport.
Hey, look, it's the moon. Did you know that the moon is thought to be about 4.51 billion years old? Did you know that? If you don't know what the moon is, it's the only astronomical body that orbits planet Earth. It's our only permanent natural satellite, guys. So, yeah, it's kind of a big deal, actually. If you're not familiar with it, I'd really appreciate you doing me a solid and checking it out. Did you also know, moon lovers, did you also know that the 17th century poet Matsuo Basho said that we should think of a haiku kind of like a finger pointing at the moon? But he said, you got to make sure that you don't put too many jewels on your finger, because then people stop looking at the moon and they start looking at the finger instead. See, it's meant to be a poetry lesson about keeping your writing simple and honest. And it's nice, isn't it? I really like that quote. I mean, Basho probably never actually said this, though it is still attributed to him all the time. There's not a huge amount of monks with bejeweled fingers wandering around back in Basho's day, Edo period Japan. Wouldn't have really been a relatable analogy. The real origin of the quote is probably the American haiku writer James W. Hackett from his 1964 book of haikus. But it doesn't really matter, really, does it? It doesn't matter whose finger it is, Basho's or Hackett's, because we're not meant to be looking at the finger, are we? We're supposed to be looking at the moon. We have to look past language, past the person who says it, and try to imagine the thing beyond. Right. I teach poetry classes from time to time, with all different ages, from about 5 years old on up. I teach in schools and prisons, hospitals. First exercise I do in pretty much every single class I teach, no matter who they are or how old they are, I ask them to describe the moon. Everyone can learn something from this exercise, I think. Write a list of metaphors, I say. The moon is an adjective noun.
The moon is a dark record. The moon is a blue church. The moon is a haunted inflatable.
Now, of course, the moon is kind of a poetic cliche. It's a pretty hackneyed romantic subject, but in many ways that makes it the perfect place to start, particularly for an unsure writer. Someone anxious about the rules and systems of poetry. It's easy to be tricked into believing that a poem arrives in the writer's mind all at once, fully formed, rather than through, you know, fucking around, which is the truth. And is there a better place to fuck around than the moon?
The moon is a sad bassist.
You see, the moon has a kind of powerful gravitational field. Obviously not in real life, of course, but in poetry it does. In poetry, the moon draws in concepts. It draws in language. Words just seem to stick to the moon. I maintain that a poet can pretty much compare the moon to anything, and the reader will read back that line and think to themselves, oh yeah, I kind of see what they're getting at.
The moon is a time-lapsed mouth. The moon is an Aztec supermarket.
It's almost as if through centuries of art and attention and manipulation, we've exaggerated the moon so much that we've broken it in our brains. And now it's just this open figurative channel. The moon is it's a kind of open goal. Well, there's another one. When doing this exercise with students, there's one other condition that I insist upon.
I ask my students to select their adjectives and nouns, not from their imagination, but from the world around them. They have to open a dictionary on a random page, or another type of book on a random page, or choose a word from a recent text message, or a word overheard on the radio or the playground. Not from the same source either. I want them to be putting together two words from two different sources. One source for the adjective, one for the noun. I'm trying to encourage them to act first, think later, to work intuitively, and to use their environment as an extension of their imagination. I also want them to smash together words that don't really belong together, to create sparks and confusion, to create a brand new, never before uttered description of the moon. Like, no matter if on first glance it just feels like gibberish. Despite the excessive commentary that already covers the moon, it is still possible to say something new about it.
The moon is a Roman floppy disk. The moon is a feline sitcom. The moon is a Hebrew kingpin.
So I've done workshops like this about once a week for about like 17 years. So I can go all day if you want. I've got reams of this stuff in folders next door.
The moon is a ubiquitous chairman.
Sometimes in class we take it further. I might ask the class, so this description of a moon here, if this was the first line in a story, what kind of story would it go on to be? Or if I was to say to you, on the day that I was born, the moon was a dead travel agent, then what kind of a person would I be? What kind of horrific person would I be? But I insist, like, we don't start thinking about any of that until after the line is written. First we write it, then we work out what it means. First the accident, then the autopsy. No matter what goes onto the page, it always seems to make sense in the end. It always seems to make sense. At least to my ears it does. That's how powerful the moon is. Everywhere you point, there's the moon. Now, language is elastic, I know that. We can stretch any metaphor pretty far before it breaks. But I think the moon is particularly suited to these kinds of manipulations. Every pool of water reflects it, after all, but it's always the same moon. I don't think Basho would like this very much, however. He was trying to encourage us to speak plainly and honestly. We got to remember, like, Basho is writing at the start of poetry, well, at least relatively at the start of poetry. The moon is so new. Back then in Edo period Japan, the moon still got that fresh car smell. Back then, the moon is still pure. It's 100% proof. Perhaps the idea of speaking honestly and plainly about the moon still felt possible then. At least it felt like something to aspire to. But that was back before millions of people lifted their ridiculous bejeweled fingers up to the sky and claimed the moon as their own. Somewhere in that endless attack, I think we broke the moon. We pointed at it so much that it kind of became everything. And I find that interesting and useful for poetry, sure. But, I mean, it also makes me feel nervous too. Because, I mean, I don't know if I want this phenomenon to spread further. I don't want to believe that if we talk long enough about anything, we end up breaking it somehow. Basho lost the moon, but I don't want him to give up on everything else. It's unsettling to imagine a world where we can no longer speak plainly on anything, where all of us are weighed down with borrowed jewels, all of language now glittering like an incomprehensible rap video. In a world like that, it's no longer the moon that's broken. It's the finger. This would be a world where anything could be considered a metaphor for anything else, and any semblance of meaning would only arrive later as an afterthought. I guess I'm saying I like the moon, but yeah, I wouldn't want to live there.
The moon is an obvious nickname. The moon is a photocopied lake. The moon. The moon. The moon. The moon. The moon. The moon. The moon.
Mate, that chorus is like a magic trick on an Afghan veranda. Bump my fist, come on.
Trojan is the worst possible name for a condom company. I am sure you agree. If my memory of ancient Greek technology serves me correctly, the primary function of the Trojan horse was, once it had passed safely through the gates of the enemy, the primary function of the Trojan horse was to spill out hundreds and hundreds of little people with swords. I don't know about you, but when I'm trying to practice safe sex, that is literally the last thing I want to happen.
Number 9.
Horses are uncomfortable in the middle and dangerous at both ends. This quote, attributed to Ian Fleming, novelist and naval intelligence officer who died age 56 of a heart attack. One could easily apply Fleming's model of a horse to other objects. Many things are dangerous at the ends and uncomfortable in the middle. A cigar, nunchucks, the Daytona International Speedway. One could even apply Fleming's horse model to a human life as a whole, i.e. mostly uncomfortable with a highly vulnerable entrance and exit. Here we see the horse represented as timeline, our life as a creature that we pass through from one end to the other, a horse called reality that slowly absorbs us until all that remains is waste product. I don't know, something to think about.
On the way back from my latest murder, I pause on the bridge to marvel at the possibility that I, Ross G. Sutherland, may never be held accountable for my crimes. Despite the near constant references to them in my poetry, the names of my murder victims disclosed in full, with burial locations and instruments of death. In my early work, I placed a red object in the still life of each poem to telegraph my latest atrocity. An Irish setter by the fire, a chili discovered on a mahogany floor, Ryan Giggs eating a Kit Kat. Each poem fitted with a pressure trigger, ready to pop should the poem be critiqued and spill its fetid cargo. My poem about a hot air balloon in Somerset, published in Views 2012, could be reversed like a sports jacket to reveal a confession about throwing a postman off a viaduct. But I gave up on metaphor when winter came. The ground was too hard. My voice gained a new sincerity. These days, I plainly describe my homicides to groups of serious young men and women at the Oldbury Poetry Festival.
Here's another one, I say, about a guy I killed in cold blood. After readings, I move to the door to wait for police, occasionally selling a book or two. Each sale, I presume, will be the last. On the flyleaf, I write, "Dear reader, I wanted to stop so many times, but why the fuck should I do the critic's job for them? Thank God it is finally over." Yet it never is. I hate my audience for not picking up on all these murders. But murdering them directly would still be cheating. I think we can all agree on that. At night, after my reading, I walk the seafront between vast black hotels that shrink and expand with the moon. I am shit at skimming stones, but I like to do so anyway. Sometimes I hear a police siren. It sounds like an old woman shouting, "Clever, clever, clever," slowly fading into the hills.
Forget what you're doing halfway through a sentence. Forget what you're doing halfway through a sentence. He opened the door and got into the car. Engine shuddered into life and the vehicle lurched down the driveway. He knew it was only a matter of time was against him and he had to do something had to be done. If there was one thing he knew, for sure as he could be under the circumstances were against him, he thought with a grim smile formed on his face the facts. Suddenly, the car jolted the car. He hadn't been watching. The road came to an abrupt stop. In front of him was a barrier. Across the road came to an abrupt stop. It was too late to slow down into the ravine. Below the car was a deep ravine. He jammed his foot on. The brakes weren't working. With a screeching metal, screech of metal screeched as he flew into the darkness, opened and swallowed him. He screamed, "No!" He screamed. His life was flashing before he even had time to think about what he had done. With his life was flashing before his eyes filled with tears of regretted so many things he regretted in his life was flashing before his eyes had time to close. His eyes filled with tears in his eyes closed.
Okay, who knows this one? Everybody now, back to the floor for one last time. Come on, boys. Eat those crisps later. Let's make the night count. Come on. Sad to say that we have reached the end of this little bonus episode. If you've already listened to the 100th episode special, then you'll know that I promised to put out a bonus clip show episode, and I did. That I did it. That you just listened to it. If you haven't yet listened to the 100th episode special, then strap in, because it is a lot of stuff going on there. Either way, I hope you got a kick out of this. I'll include a list of the sampled episodes in the show notes, just in case you want to hunt down anything later. I'm not sure if the clips I chose were really the best bits of the podcast, but they were the bits that could function the best independently of the episodes they originally came from, and so that's why I chose them. If I was being honest, probably my multi-part audio fictions are my actual best episodes, like Sex and the City The Return or Exorcist Dave Stewart. However, placed into a context like this, they would be shit. Finally, if you'd like to support the show, you can go to my Patreon page. That's www.patreon.com/RossGSutherland. Or you can make a one-off donation via buymeacoffee.com/imaginaryadvice. Thanks again to everybody who already supports the show in whatever way that they can. Thank you for making my dreams a reality. I sound insincere. I'm not. It's just the voice. It's just the voice. I'm genuinely. Anyway. The point is, if it wasn't for you, there's just no way that this podcast would have run for 100 years. Episodes, not years. I mean episodes. Can you imagine if this podcast had been going for 100 years? If it began in 1924. Anyway, my name is Ross Sutherland. All this time, blah, blah, blah. Thanks for listening.
To picture something for me. Picture a little froggy. Just make that mental image in your head. A little froggy sitting on a lily pad. He's looking right at you with those big round eyes. Eyes like big glass marbles. Eyes staring right into you. Close your eyes and picture this little froggy sitting on a lily pad. On a huge, empty lake that stretches right to the horizon. And now he's drifting away. The lily pad drifting away from you. He's still looking right at you, and you're looking right at him as he drifts further and further away. Keep looking at him. As he gets smaller and smaller, as he drifts towards the horizon. Smaller and smaller, until he's just a speck of dust on a still, endless lake. Keep looking. Keep looking. Move your eyes now, back and forth along the horizon, just like you were reading a difficult line in a poem. A difficult line in a poem that you suspect was specifically written about you. Do you know this poet? How does this poet know so much about you? Do they know your secrets? Is that what the poem is getting at? Read the line again. Move your eyes back and forth, back and forth along the line. What does it mean? What does it mean?